I want to talk to you just for a moment this morning about failure. But I assure you, though it's a very serious subject, you won't go home feeling depressed. Well, I hope so. I hope not. Well, have a biscuit and a cup of tea. All the readings that we've just heard, all three readings, are about being called and commissioned. There's Isaiah in the temple in Jerusalem in 742 BC, roughly. There's Paul reminding his readers in Corinth, church very much like this one, lots of different people, different occupations, lively, urban, intelligent, handsome, beautiful. Well, no, but with its own problems, Corinth had its rivalries and its difficulties, arguments, not always sure where it was going, but a lively church that Paul loved because he wrote at least two, probably three or four letters, a couple of which have been subsumed into the ones we have today. And Paul reminds his readers about his own encounter with Christ and how that left him feeling. And then we have Luke's account we just heard of Simon Peter's call. And it's interesting to wonder why the people, the committee that constructed our lectionary, arranged those three readings to be read on the same Sunday. It's always interesting to see what links them. And it struck me that what linked them all was failure, inadequacy. See, there's plenty of other readings in the Bible which deal with discipleship and how God approaches us and calls us and yanks us out of the familiar and encourages us to take some new venture on. But the link between these three is that Isaiah, Paul, and Simon Peter were all made aware very acutely of their own inadequacy. Isaiah is given a glimpse of God's holiness and made aware that he and all humanity are, in his own words, unclean, unfit to worship such a God. Paul does it slightly differently. He lists those who've witnessed the risen Christ. Interesting, he actually forgets that the women were the first ones to do that. But we're forgiven for that. But he lists the people and he says, last of all, he appeared to me. And then Simon, later to me known as Peter, of course, is overcome with his own sinfulness. Depart from me, I'm a sinful man. But the point about these characters is not that they lacked qualifications, either spiritual or mental or physical. It goes much deeper than this. I want to tell you a story. I don't often give, I very rarely give testimonies, I must admit. But I want to tell you a story, which I hope will sort of illustrate this and just make a couple of very brief points afterwards. On two occasions in my life, I've nearly drowned. The first was when I was about 9 years old. I'd just started to teach myself how to swim, but I couldn't swim more than about one or two meters, less than that, and then I'd have to grab onto the edge. But I was just starting to, and I went over to see some friends who were near the end, the deep end of this pool, and the pool that we swam in was a very large open air pool. It was 120 yards by 30, whatever that is in meters, and salt water, open air, wonderful pool. And The deep end was just under 12 foot, which is what, 3.5 meters, something like that. And a very kind, thoughtful person decided that I needed to be encouraged to swim a bit more and pushed me in the deep end. And I nearly drowned until I was rescued by a large, muscular, middle-aged lady who yanked me to the edge of the pool, got me out. I was much smaller then, obviously. Put me on the side and did resuscitation and brought me round. And I remembered at the time that it was an alarming experience, but not a terrifying one. The second occasion, though, was much more serious. It happened when I was in college, at Wesley College, Bristol, training for the ministry. And so we're talking about 1982-83. And Joan and I had taken the boys in our rickety caravan to Cornwall. And one afternoon, we all went down to the beach at Whitsand Bay. Some of you may know this. It's a lovely beach between Plymouth and Loo. And it was an incredible day, hot, cloudless, but lovely day. And a lot of sand, though the beach didn't happen to be very crowded, nor was the water particularly. Joan, who doesn't swim but loves baths, was watching John and Paul, who were, what would they be, 8 and 10, 7 and 9 years of age, make sandcastles. And I just decided to have a dip. And although I'd been quite a strong swimmer when I was in my teens and early 20s, could swim well over a mile without any problems, by this time, I was in my 30s, I'd acquired perhaps a little bit of wisdom and fear, I don't know, and I never went out of my depth when I was in the sea. I always made sure I had my feet on the bottom. And my first inkling that this beach was famous for its riptides and had, usually one person drown every year. We found that out afterwards. Was when I heard shouts of panic coming from behind me, further out to sea. And I turned round, and clearly there was a young lad some distance away, about 30 or 40 metres away, who was obviously in difficulties. And a man who was another swimmer, who was a bit younger than me, whizzed past me towards this boy, and I followed. I didn't think at all. I just turned and followed. And then after a short while, as I looked up to where the boy was, I realized that he was not getting closer, but he was actually getting further away. And I carried on swimming towards the lad, but after about 5 minutes ago, I remember looking back at the shore and being shocked how far out we were. I could barely see Joan, John and Paul standing on the sand at the water's edge with a crowd of other people, but they were just tiny dots in the distance. And a number of things flashed through my mind, because particularly when you're younger, you think you're immortal, and accidents happen to other people. Cancer happens to other people. You don't think that things like that are going to happen to you. But anyway, several thoughts flashed through my mind. The first was, I am going to drown. This will happen to me. Joan will be widowed, and John and Paul will be orphaned. And the other thought that was virtually simultaneous in my mind was that this boy, if I'm going to drown, this boy's going to drown as well. So I left him. I left him. Almost in a panic, I turned round. I shouted to the man swimming beside me, he was a bit further on, and said, I've got to go back. And I just made it to the shore. I remember, I don't know how long it took me, but I remember crawling on my hands and knees. I was too exhausted even to stand up. I crawled on my hands and knees at the beach. And within a moment or so, he had done the same thing. Shaking with exhaustion and full of mixed emotions. Relief at having survived, and then horror and guilt at what I'd done. The boy, incidentally, was swept. I would never have got him. He was swept onto a rocky promontory and was actually rescued by people who'd gone round on the rocks. I mean, he was battered and bruised. Nothing broken. He had a few cuts and abrasions. But he, in shock, naturally, but he was okay. But the thing was, I didn't know that when I turned back. I thought that I'd left him to his death. And as long as I live, I will never forget that feeling. I mean, people I've talked to who've fought in war, one or two, I think, have more or less said that they went through the same sort of experience in battle. But I will never forget leaving somebody to die. And it strikes me, you see, we live in a fallen world. Even though we can, just to quote Charles Wesley, use our best endeavors to serve God, everything that we do is somehow tainted. I can't think of a better word. It's a problem. Now, when a couple of years earlier, I spent about a year and a half agonizing as to whether I should offer as a candidate for the ordained ministry. And I had huge reservations. Would I get through the theological training? Would I be able to master New Testament Greek? Would I be able to cope with difficult pastoral situations? I mean, we had one this morning, a visitor out of the blue, Vernon, this morning. Thanks to Kevin and the stewards. Hopefully we've helped him on his way. Would I be able to tackle awkward church councils? Well, some of you may have long memories and will have formed your own opinions about that one. Would I be able to sustain a preaching ministry 2, maybe even 3 times every Sunday? But it wasn't just that. My reservation was an echo of what Simon Peter and Isaiah and Paul expressed in those readings. A feeling that, you know, despite our best efforts, despite our most earnest intentions of ourselves, we cannot succeed. And it's not just us. It's the world we live in. It's the situations we encounter. Everything around us, even, which often makes the decisions that we're faced with not so much a matter of choosing between good and evil. I mean, it's so naive to think of that Christians are just faced with those choices. You know as well as I do. It's much more a case of choosing between different shades of grey. And sometimes, God forgive us, it's making a choice between bad and worse. And in another letter, Paul expresses this sort of sense of frustration when he cries out, this is to the Romans, I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I do. This sense of wrestling with the overwhelming odds that Christians have felt down the ages, as if life itself was conspiring against us. Now, please don't get depressed or think, oh no. Thank God there is an answer. And the paradox is, it's very difficult to grasp, but it's so simple. You see, you might think that living with failure is about just maturing as Christians, growing up and accepting the fact that, we have limitations and getting on with it. Well, there's an element of truth in that, but that's a recipe at best for, gloom and fatalism, and at worst, spiritual depression. There's a much better way of dealing with this inevitable problem of failure in discipleship. Now, think of those three characters that we heard about just a moment ago. Isaiah, when his lips are touched with a burning coal, I know it's all figurative language, but it symbolizes his forgiveness. And because of that, he responds to the voice he hears, even though he's no idea of the task that he'll be called to do. Paul, his credentials lie not in his innate ability. And we've got to remember that Paul was incredibly gifted. He would have had multiple doctorates to his name if he'd been alive today. Two-thirds of the New Testament was written by him anyway. But his credentials lie in his being commissioned by the risen Christ. And his value as an apostle, as one of Christ's disciples, lies not in anything that he has, but in God's grace. You have a baptism next Sunday, Julia. It'll be a lovely service. I hope you all come. I don't know anything about the details, but I'm sure what she'll say about this baby that's going to be baptized, it's all about God's grace. Even before this boy or girl has got any awareness of what's going on. That's why we baptize adults, of course, and I'm sorry to digress, but you know me. We baptize adults in the Methodist Church. Of course we do. Baptize a 77-year-old. But the reason why we baptize little babies is that it is a mark, it's a reminder that our faith does not begin with us. Doesn't. You know, going to church and trying to behave and live good lives, and it's popular folk religion. And it's so attractive superficially. You know, if we're good and keep to the rules and follow the commandments and serve God and use our best endeavors, then, you know, we'll be rewarded with eternal life. Rubbish! Christ died for us while we were yet sinners. God doesn't wait for us to become good or well-behaved, and he doesn't even wait for us to grow up. He loves us from the moment we're a twinkle in our father and mother's eyes. You know, he loves us from the beginning. We belong to him. See, Simon Peter knows that he's flawed. Go away from me, Lord, he says. I am a sinful man. But he contains the right material, the potential. It's like every child that we baptize does. In a moment, we're going to sing. I thought of what hymn to have after this. I thought of one who is all unfit to count as scholar in thy school. Thou of thy love has named a friend, O kindness wonderful. It's not in our book, though, by an Indian Christian. Wonderful, wonderful hymn. But we're going to sing an even older one, if you bear with me in a second. A Galilean fisher's toil all night and nothing take, which is based on that gospel passage. And one of the verses has, A frail one, thrice denying thee, saw mercy in thy eyes. But remember that. The penitent upon the tree was born to paradise. You see, there's an objective side to all those three readings. There's an objective side to Isaiah and Paul and Simon Peter's encounter with God that overrides their subjective feelings of weakness, sin, or unworthiness. And that means, thank God, that you and I need always to set aside the ideas, conventions, standards, and any folk religion with which we've been brought up and which modern society holds. And remember that what qualifies us in God's eyes is not our academic ability or our physical strength or our mental resources or emotional qualities and not even our spiritual virtues. It is God in His mercy who forgives us. It is God in His mercy who heals us. It's God in His mercy who restores us, who chooses us, not us. It is God in His mercy and love who equips us. It's God who brings us our discipleship to fruition. And that's why never doubt that as individuals and never doubt it as a church. Don't get depressed about Trinity's future. There's no need to be. God hasn't finished with us yet by a long chalk. Because you and I, frail as we are, failures though we may be, can know the joy and peace of living in God's mercy and grace as we seek to become the people that He longs for us to be. And now we're going to sing this little hymn.